Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find three new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the hour, on the brink of summer break, we'll talk with IPR's Grant Gerlach about this challenging year in Iowa's public schools. Also, reaction in that, of course, to the governor's ban on mask mandates just a few days ago. Cassidy Arena takes us to a Des Moines memorial for George Floyd and the Gazette's Michaela Ram with a vaccination update. Also, some COVID travel tips if you're thinking of flying in the near future. You'll want to keep up to date on those. But first, nearly 3 years ago, the case sparked a month-long manhunt that drew national attention. Yesterday, at the Scott County Courthouse in Davenport, the jury began deliberations in the trial of Molly Tibbetts' accused killer, 26-year-old Christian Behena Rivera, accused of killing Tibbetts, 20-year-old University of Iowa student, in July of 2018, hiding her body in a cornfield. IPR's Kate Payne has been following the trial, which began last week. Hello, Kate.
Hi.
We are still waiting for the verdict, which could come at any time, correct?
Yeah, we are still waiting. The jurors have been deliberating in this case for over 6 hours at this point. And it's sort of a wait and see right now. I can tell you a little bit about the jury itself. We know that there are 5 women and 7 men, and 3 of them identify as Hispanic or Latino, and the rest are white.
Mm-hmm. Remind us, so what does the prosecution contend happened back in July of 2018 to Molly Tibbetts?
Right. So the state's case, they say it comes down to 3 things. Surveillance video footage, Behena Rivera's own admissions to police, and DNA evidence. So his car was seen on home security video in the area where Tibbetts was thought to be running on the evening she disappeared in July of 2018. And that's how officers tracked down Behena Rivera and ultimately brought him in for an 11-hour interview. It was over the course of that interview that he told them he confronted Tibbetts on the road that day, that she got angry with him and threatened to call the police. And then he said that he blacked out and came to, remembering that her body was in his trunk, which he hid in a cornfield. And at the end of that interview, he led officers to her body. And ultimately, her blood was found in the trunk of his car. And prosecutors argued that that evidence in total is overwhelming and irrefutable.
Mm-hmm. Then this week, you can say how much of a surprise this was. It seems to be the defense rested his case after Behena Rivera took the stand in his own defense, and he had an alternate explanation of the killing. What was that?
Yes, it's quite rare for him to do that, and was a big surprise even in this very closely watched trial. But he told a story that was completely new, claiming that 2 masked armed men showed up in his home and that they forced him to drive them around while they chased Tibbetts. And he said that it was these 2 masked men who were responsible for her death and that they were the ones who put her body in his trunk. And he said that before disappearing, they threatened Behena Rivera's own daughter and her mother, and that then they left him with the body, which he hid in a cornfield. And he testified that he never told officers about any of this because he was scared of retaliation against his family. He said he took those threats seriously.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how he seemed on the stand telling this alternative version.
He seemed calm. He seemed collected. It certainly seemed, this was something that his defense attorneys had gone over with him at length, that he was prepared to make these statements in depth. He did seem candid. They acknowledged that that the blood was in his trunk and that he did take her body and place it in that cornfield. But you know, it can be hard to read emotion, certainly in situations like this.
Yeah. How did the prosecution, I believe Prosecutor Scott Brown in this case, react to this surprise alternative account from Bahena Rivera?
Well, certainly in the moment, prosecutors were taking furious notes, you know, as they were hearing this evidence, this testimony come from Bahena Rivera. As far as their response, prosecutors said that, you know, this story about these two masked men is a figment of Bahena Rivera's imagination, is how they put it, that they found the claims unbelievable and a desperate effort by him to get out from under all of this other evidence. And they raised questions about, you know, who were these men? How did they find Bahena Rivera? How did they know about his daughter? How did they get to his trailer? How did they get away from the cornfield? These kinds of things. And prosecutors just urged jurors to focus back on the evidence that they had presented of the video, the admission, and the DNA evidence of her blood in his trunk.
Mm-hmm. Aside from this obvious, the testimony of Bahena Rivera, what other testimony stood out during the trial that started last week?
Well, we certainly heard a lot of testimony from people who knew Bahena Rivera as well. One of the defense's, arguments, it seemed, was to sketch out him as a person and his lived experience as an undocumented immigrant in Iowa, which for an overwhelmingly white jury and an overwhelmingly white state might have been quite educational for folks, just as far as everything he was doing to provide for his family while working under a false name and while trying to stay undetected by law enforcement. And support his family in the U.S. and back in Mexico, working in the dairy industry. We also heard from Dalton Jack, who is Tibbetts' boyfriend, who was a subject of suspicion over the course of the investigation because of his closeness to Tibbetts. And he acknowledged inconsistent stories that he had made to law enforcement, and was something of a quite reluctant witness.
Mm-hmm. And Bahena Rivera, didn't he mention in his alternative account something about these supposed masked men mentioning the name Jack?
Yes, Bahena Rivera said that one of the men went off to chase after Tibbetts and that another man stayed in the car with him, and that man had been muttering and allegedly said, "Come on, Jack." In the testimony, Bahena Rivera did say he doesn't know who those two masked men are, and he was not implying that one of them was Dalton Jack, but he said that is what he heard.
Mm-hmm. Kate, tell us more about the victim here, Molly Tibbetts, the 20-year-old University of Iowa student who died in 2018, was killed.
Yeah, again, she was studying at the UI. She had just finished her freshman year. She was studying psychology, and she was an avid runner. She also, from basically all accounts, was just a wonderful person, a caring person who loved to help others. Who hoped to go to grad school and work in psychology and psychiatry and to help others professionally in her life, that she was a loving daughter, close to her family, had really good friends, and was just a kind person and really seemed just at the beginning of what promised to be a really wonderful and just a good life.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, the closing arguments of both the defense and the prosecution, beginning in the morning before the jury did have some hours yesterday afternoon to deliberate. They continue deliberating, as far as we know, at this hour. Tell us about the closing arguments yesterday.
Well, again, from the state, you know, they were really trying to poke holes in Bahena Rivera's account of these two men. This story that Bahena Rivera had never given to police, had never apparently spoken of before. Bahena Rivera testified that he probably would have gone to the grave with this information, except that police found him and approached him. So the state again saying, you know, come back to this evidence that they had presented of the video, the admissions, and the DNA, that, you know, possibilities alone should not sway the jury away from the case that they had made. And for the defense, they argued that despite the evidence, that the state did not prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, posing questions about who else could have been involved. They had been casting doubt on, again, Tibbetts' boyfriend, Dalton Jack, as well as other local sex offenders, people with a history of violence that tipsters had called in about. And the defense argued that the client just would have never done this, that as an undocumented immigrant working some 75 hours a week at a dairy farm, as a devoted family man with no history of violence, that he just wanted to work hard and keep his head down and provide for his family.
What does Bahena Rivera face if convicted of first-degree murder, Kate?
He faces the possibility of life in prison without parole.
Okay. Awaiting the verdict in this trial. Thank you, Kate Payne, IPRs. Kate Payne has been watching covering this trial since last week. Christian Bahena Rivera, 26-year-old, accused of killing the then 20-year-old University of Iowa student in July of 2018, hiding her body in a cornfield. And we remember that long manhunt that drew so much national attention. Kate Payne, thank you so much for your account here. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we're on the brink of summer vacation from the school. From school. Hard to believe when we look or walk outside that it is closing in on June. Next week we'll have June. What a challenging year it's been for students and parents. Let's take stock of it with IPR's Grant Gerlach. Hello, Grant.
Hey, Ben.
Well, with COVID fading and with that restrictions on COVID, how are schools marking the end of the school year, specifically graduations?
Well, I think you've seen a big difference when it comes to the graduations. You know, COVID was so disruptive last year when it came to the graduation ceremonies. A lot of schools were doing virtual graduations. Some schools would do workarounds. Like, I remember Des Moines had these personal commencements where the graduates would basically just kind of walk through one at a time with a few family members there to get their diplomas. Mm-hmm. None of the big crowds last year, but the crowds are back this year. Things look much more like normal. Large gatherings, bleachers full of family and friends, the whole nine yards. Some schools were going to require masks at graduations or limit the number of people who could attend, that kind of thing. But some of the schools with those limits have since lifted them for graduations. For instance, Sioux City is having their commencements at the Tyson Event Center there tomorrow, and they've opened that up now for anyone to attend. Similar story with Cedar Rapids. They're holding commencement at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse starting last night, actually, and they're opening it up too. And they're also having video streams too, so people who either can't be there or prefer not to go there can watch a live stream of it.
Mm-hmm. It was only just a few days ago that we had, well, the surprising news that school districts no longer could require students to wear masks. The rules changed literally overnight, the governor mandating that with a ban on mask mandates. Tell us a little bit about, and it's really a mixed reaction here, how school districts have been reacting to the governor's ban.
Yeah, I think initially from a lot of parents in school districts, there was, you know, a mixture of confusion and surprise. And part of that has to do with the fact that this proposal hadn't been around for very long publicly. It was an amendment to a bill, so it didn't go through the subcommittee process where there would be public input for people who are supporting it or are against it. Didn't go through committee hearings. It was just added onto this bill that had lots of other different kinds of school-related proposals within it. And another part of the confusion comes, as you mentioned, because it was signed into law around midnight and took effect immediately. So by the next morning, families were getting up and schools were getting ready to welcome students, and the rules had changed, and masks could no longer be required. They had to be optional. And many schools had already done that, but a lot of schools hadn't. So they were really adjusting on the fly to this new law that was passed and figuring out how they wanted to respond. And, you know, there was definitely a group of parents who had been lobbying for this kind of change for a long time, lobbying their districts or lobbying the governor. And they wanted to have a choice for themselves or for their students to choose whether to wear a mask. But there are also many parents who were immediately concerned about the potential consequences of sending their child to school, not knowing if their classmates would be wearing masks. And that's because there's still a dangerous virus out there. I remember listening into a school board meeting for Ankeny a couple weeks ago, and there was a mother who spoke to that school board and talked about her son who became sick and ended up in intensive care with severe inflammation that turned out to be caused by COVID-19, and they hadn't known that that he had had the virus. Mm-hmm. And he recovered, but he has not been back to school since then because of heart damage caused by that inflammation. Mm. And, you know, those are rare cases, but it's why some parents have been relying on those masks, and it's why the CDC and others have been asking that students continue to wear them.
Right, and that is our ticket out of this horrible pandemic, along with social distancing, masking, and, of course, the vaccination campaign. But back to the governor's ban on mask mandates in schools, is it clear what that means, or is it depending on some situations? I'm thinking of buses, for instance, where you're in close quarters. There may not be the ventilation or the social distancing possible.
The buses are a little bit of a peculiar situation. There are still some schools that are requiring masks on buses. Des Moines and Ames are two of those. And they say that's because there's a CDC order for face masks on public transportation. And the CDC, when they talk about public transportation, they're talking about everything from airplanes to subways to city buses and school buses, too. If you look at the law that was passed last week, it says masks cannot be required on school property. It doesn't name buses. So it's a little bit of a gray area. So it definitely means in schools. When it comes to buses, it's a few schools are still requiring them. A lot of them aren't. They've made it optional on buses. But it's one way that at least a few schools have held on to, you know, a sliver of a mandate in a situation where kids could be crowded together and there could be more of a chance of the virus spreading in a situation like that. Mm-hmm. But it leaves a lot of questions open for next year, too, because, you know, the vaccine trials have started for young children. You know, those are in progress, and hopefully there's good news that comes out of those. But right now, kids under 12 are not eligible for a vaccine, and that might not change by the time school starts again next year. And it's not a given that schools will be offering virtual learning next year. You know, that was a requirement this year, but it's kind of hit or miss whether schools are going to continue that kind of program. They might continue it for some grades, but not others. So it's not guaranteed to be an option for all families if they're concerned about the potential public health environment in their school buildings.
Right, and we have to be especially concerned of families with immunocompromised members going to schools. Grant, of course, over the summer, it's often a time when a school wants to do renovations or anything here, but I suppose this summer, ventilation will be checked out, retrofitting of better ventilation in many cases across the state and across the country, right?
Yeah, that's something schools will need to keep up. But schools will still be pretty busy over the summer. There are a lot of expanded summer school programs that will be going on either in schools or with community organizations offering extra classes, extra learning to try to catch up, kind of add to what students were learning during the school year, keep things going strong going into next year, trying to catch up from lost learning from the various shutdowns related to COVID over the past year. So they're going to try to keep the ball rolling, kind of going into next year and see what they can catch up on.
Mm-hmm. Of course, so many Iowans not fully vaccinated. I wonder how they fit into the school picture. How do families and children who have chosen not to vaccinate and don't plan on it figure into this? Discussions on that?
Yeah, I think when you look at the recommendations that are coming from the CDC, a lot of it still revolves around what you can do if you're vaccinated, what you can do if you're not vaccinated. And that's still part of what they're looking at with schools in terms of recommending vaccines for all the students who are eligible for it. And there will still be efforts to try to get students in to get those vaccines.
Yep.
There have been clinics happening at schools to try to make it easy for students to have access to those vaccines. So there are definitely efforts for schools to make those available and easy to acquire for the students who are eligible so far. And if that expands, hopefully soon, they'll be able to keep that up and make more plans to vaccinate more students.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way for them to make sure that the schools are going to be safe from COVID next year.
I read that the Iowa City Community School District Superintendent Matt Degner said districts, because of this ban on mask mandates, could see an increase in quarantine numbers now that they no longer can require students and staff to wear masks. I wonder if that's echoed by other superintendents, if there's other talk, such talk of an uptick in quarantines.
Well, it was kind of a funny back and forth that was going on when it comes to masks and quarantine. A couple weeks ago, before the governor signed this bill into law, there was a new guidance from the state public health department that recommended schools not require masks and also that they not continue with quarantining students who are exposed to COVID-19. And before that, quarantine had been based on whether students had been masked when they're close to one another. So if there was an exposure, but everyone had their masks on, they didn't have to quarantine. And that was sort of an incentive for students to wear masks, because if you didn't want to go into quarantine, make sure you're wearing a mask. But now the state is saying, they want schools to treat COVID-19 like other illnesses. If you're sick, stay home. They're not looking at treating it the way they had earlier this school year.
Okay, Grant Gerlach, thank you for reflections on a very tough school year now coming to an end. Grant Gerlach of Iowa Public Radio. Thank you, Grant.
Ready for summer break. Thanks, Ben.
You deserve it. Cassidy Arena comes on with me in just a moment to talk about a Des Moines memorial for George Floyd. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Iowa PBS. For more than 45 years, Market to Market has provided perspective on the commodities, from farm gate to dinner plate. Find 3 new agribusiness podcasts each week, the M2M Podcast, Market Analysis, and Market Plus, all available wherever you subscribe and listen to podcasts.
And we're back with this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a moment, the Gazette's Michaela Ram with some COVID travel tips. Of course, this week, across the nation, also here in Iowa, Americans yearning for racial justice marked the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder by a Minneapolis police officer. IPR's Cassidy Arena attended a memorial held in downtown Des Moines on Wednesday. Cassidy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Midweek, we had much warmer, better temperatures for such an outdoor gathering. Describe the gathering and what took place there.
Yeah, so first to mention, it was actually in the forecast that it was going to rain that day, but the rain actually held off, much to everybody's pleasure at the memorial for George Floyd. A few groups of people showed up. They all stood still 6 feet apart from each other, although masks weren't as popular anymore. I'm assuming as more people are getting vaccinated, they feel a little bit more comfortable without the masks. And it was basically just a memorial to remember the name of George Floyd and the legacy that his murder has left behind.
So, Cassidy, tell us about the range of speakers who offered their thoughts at this memorial.
Yeah, there were quite a few speakers lined up to speak. All of them were introduced by the MC, Al Womble, who's actually the chair of the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus, as well as the other host, Reverend Rob Johnson. He's the director of No Justice, No Peace. So he's been a very active voice in the whole time after George Floyd's murder. They were able to introduce a few speakers who were kind of able to put things into context for us. So, for instance, speaker and attorney Ben Lynch, he actually talked about, how people can protect themselves in encounters with police officers and what they need to know and what they need to bring if they plan on attending a protest. So, again, it was kind of contextual information, as well as you had Connie Ryan, who's the executive director of Interfaith Alliance, just kind of in a general sense discussing how Floyd's legacy has really instilled calls for racial justice, not just in Iowa, but around the world. One of the speakers who really hit hard was West Des Moines Councilwoman Renee Hardman. She was basically saying that we all need to step up where George Floyd was taken down. So in her exact words, it's up to us to stand up when he cannot stand up, and up to us to breathe the air that he wasn't able to breathe. So she was really able to hit that more somber note of what you would think of in a memorial to somebody who has passed. Another influential speaker was the 18-year-old Norwalk student, Josie Mulvihill. And she was basically talking about all of her work that she has done in her community school district, just kind of being outspoken against any injustice that she's experienced as a student. So you had people of all ages, people of all races, people of all faith backgrounds speaking, and it all wrapped up with a prayer from Democratic State Representative Akeo Abdul-Samad of Des Moines.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Reverend Rob Johnson, one of the hosts of the event. You reported on one of his quotes that really struck home with me. If I'm remembering it correctly, it may have happened 3.5 hours up the road, he said, but it still happened here as well. So that's one thing that I mean, not only across here in Iowa, not too far from the Twin Cities, but across the country and across the world, this ripple effect, this yearning for racial justice, really quite remarkable. And in that gathering there, you just mentioned it briefly, what's special about this movement is it's not just a movement of black or brown-skinned Americans, right?
Exactly. And I think the reason why Reverend Johnson had mentioned it also happened here was because it really could have happened anywhere. He talked about how he himself is a black man, and he motioned to his young nephew, who was also in attendance, who's still a child at this point. But he said, it could have been any one of us. It could have been me. It could have been my nephew. It could have been anybody in the crowd that day. So I think part of it was just really localizing it to the point of it really could have been anybody. And it's up to us, to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. Cassidy, and finally, in a few words, upon leaving that memorial, how would you describe the mood? Hopeful?
I would definitely say the mood is hopeful. Reverend Johnson and Al Womble actually kind of wrapped up reminding people that they were going on a tour from the Iowa coast to Iowa coast to continue the fight for racial justice. So it was definitely a hopeful but still a somber note to remember exactly why this memorial was even happening in the first place.
IPR reporter Cassidy Arena. Thank you so much, Cassidy.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's get an update on vaccinations and infections, our pandemic update this week from Michaela Ram, health reporter for the Gazette. Hi, Michaela.
Hey, Ben.
In just a moment, I think you're going to give us some summer travel tips, especially when we get on board flights, as those have picked up dramatically. But first of all, tell us, how do the latest numbers look in terms of infections and the vaccination campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. So according to the latest numbers we have at the Gazette, so new numbers from Thursday, we added 132 new COVID cases and 4 new confirmed deaths. Now, the good news on that, though, is the state 7-day average is going down dramatically. I think we've seen 15 days in a row where the 7-day average of new cases has consecutively dropped. So now we're at 140 cases, which is around the rate we saw last spring when cases were first starting to ramp up back at the beginning of the pandemic. So good news on that realm. Cases are going down, but it should be noted that they are still spreading. But on the other end, vaccines are still underway. We are still distributing them. Latest numbers I saw, 1.3 million individuals are now fully vaccinated, which is about 41% of the population. So, you know, the vaccine effort has slowed down, but we are seeing that number trickle upward.
So, Michaela, with infections way down, hospitalizations down to numbers we haven't seen in quite a while, this is due, of course, at least in part, to the number of vaccinations among Iowans. How is that looking?
Yeah, absolutely. So at this point, we have about 2 million doses administered. So about 1.3 million individuals are now fully vaccinated in Iowa, which accounts to about 41% of the state's total population. Now, I know we've talked a lot about vaccine efforts have really slowed down. I know public health officials are really not seeing the demand that we were seeing early on. But those numbers are slowly trickling up, and that may be because a lot of people are opting to get the vaccine ahead of momentous events over the weekend, or maybe because the efforts on the part of public health officials are working.
Mm-hmm. You're seeing the advantages of getting vaccinated, not only for individuals, but for our society, so that we can exit this pandemic as quickly as possible. Now, Michaela, before the break, I spoke with IPR's Grant Gerlach, and he described how the ban on mask mandates at schools was received. What are you seeing otherwise during this, I guess it's been referred as a great unmasking? What have you been watching?
Yeah, well, first off, you're seeing a lot of people's faces that you weren't seeing all year, so that's
yes,
kind of a new thing going out in public. But otherwise, you know, we're seeing a lot of cities and counties issue their own mask mandates earlier on, but now they're starting to ease those mandates back in light of the CDC's new guidance. So Cedar Rapids, for example, no longer really has a mask mandate. Now city officials and public health officials are still recommending mask mandates or masking when you enter these areas, but they're not mandating them. But we're also seeing businesses like Hy-Vee no longer require masking when you enter their store. So as you go out and about, you see some people masking, you see some people not masking, because now you can if you are fully vaccinated. So that's kind of been a change over the course of the last couple weeks.
Michaela, finally, with summer upon us, even though the temperatures today don't quite feel like it, and COVID releasing its grip, we have a boom in travel, don't we? What can you tell us about the type of travel procedures, restrictions people will encounter when they fly out of an airport, for instance, the Eastern Iowa Airport near Cedar Rapids?
Yeah, so the Eastern Iowa Airport has had health screenings mandated for all passengers passing through the airport since January. But airport officials announced this week that they are no longer doing those health screenings. They are going to be ending their contract to do those screenings come July 1. So you will still have to do that over the holiday weekend, but in the near future, you will no longer have to, because airport officials say, you know, travelers are coming up, but also COVID numbers are going down. It's less of a concern to have a positive case pass through. But at the same time, you know, should we see those COVID cases locally increase, or we have a change in the direction of the pandemic, they are willing to reinstate those. But come this summer, most likely you won't have to worry about that as you pass through the airport.
Mm-hmm. But once you're on the plane, Michaela, the mask mandate still holds, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So you are still required to wear a mask on an airplane. And I believe the airport still recommends wearing masks when you're out and about in the airport as well.
Okay, Michaela Ram, health reporter for The Gazette. Take care. Have a great weekend, Michaela.
Thank you. You too, Ben.
I don't think I dreamt it. Not too long ago, we had our first taste of warmer weather, even muggy weather, just a few days ago. Now we're back to much cooler temperatures, and we're hearing even a frost advisories for some parts of Iowa tonight. Let's find out what's happening and what we can expect for the long Memorial Day weekend from Corey Martin, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Des Moines. Hi, Corey.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. We want to know what happened to our warmer, summery weather in the last few days. Explain the recent weather pattern change.
Well, in short, you can blame Canada if you'd like. We just have a strong area of high pressure that's dropped south out of Canada that's now in place over the region, and it's brought some unseasonably cool temperatures to the state.
Mm-hmm. And so what's happening this year, this spring, that this is obviously not typical weather for the end of May, beginning of June. So what, I mean, is there a reason that cold air mass dropped from Canada?
No, it's just kind of a pattern that we've been stuck in. It seems like more often than not this year, the main storm track has been south of the state, which has kept a lot of that, you know, more hot and humid conditions that we would typically start to see this time of year has been bottled up to our south, which could also be the reason why we haven't seen that much severe weather so far this year either.
Mm-hmm. So what parts of the state, how serious is this frost advisory?
Well, the locations that would be most likely to see frost form, areas of frost formation tonight would be probably the northern and eastern peripheries of the state, where temperatures look like they're probably going to drop down into the mid-30s. Could be a few spots, in low-lying areas and river valleys that drop close to freezing up there. That's going to be dependent on cloud cover clearing out here, but just looking on satellite right now, it's clear across most of Minnesota, and we expect the clearing skies to drop south across our state here later today into tonight, too. So should be prime conditions for temperatures to drop well below normal for this time of year, especially up northern and eastern Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Corey, take us through the weekend. What can we expect after that cold snap tonight? Will it warm up?
It's going to take a little bit for us to really climb out of this. We're going to be hanging around in the 60s for highs for most of the weekend, which is a good 10 to 15 degrees below average for late May. But the good news is it doesn't look like it's going to be a washout. I mean, there are some chances for isolated scattered showers and maybe a few rumbles of thunder Sunday into Monday, but it doesn't look like anything that's going to be something that's going to wreck your plans for the weekend by any means. So it looks like we're just going to be dealing with a relatively cool Memorial Day weekend across the state.
Well, we have some sun at least, Corey.
Yeah. It looks like we're going to break out of the clouds here tonight and tomorrow. A good chunk of the state should see some sunshine.
Mm-hmm. What can be said about a longer term as we enter June next week? What does the weather crystal ball say there?
Yeah, as we get toward the latter half of next week, it does look like we're going to start warming back up. And by next weekend, we'll probably be back to more typical conditions that we would see here in June, where it looks like the heat will return, at least by that. I mean, we'll be back in the 80s and then with some humidity as well, which that'd be a change too, because we did just recently have a bout with some fairly muggy conditions, but it was still relatively cool. So I don't think we've really gotten that true taste of summer around here just yet.
How has this spring matched up to others in terms of severe weather in the Midwest so far, Corey?
It's been, for Iowa specific, it's been very quiet. In fact, since we've been keeping track back to the late 80s, at least for our forecast area, which we cover 51 counties in central Iowa, we've issued the fewest number of severe or tornado warnings since we began keeping track in the late 80s. In fact, it's not even close. We've only issued 7 to date. And typically by this time of year, it's not unheard of us for us to be above 100. It's just been very, very quiet on that front so far this year. But we know we've seen some pretty significant severe weather events in June, and it only takes one bad night to change the whole narrative of a season. So
Yes.
It definitely wouldn't let your guard down just because it's been quiet to this point.
Yes. We know from last year, we can't let our guard down, even into July and August. Corey.
Exactly. Yep.
Corey Martin, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Des Moines. Thanks for a little explanation and a look ahead, Corey. Have a great weekend.
Yes, you too. Thanks for having me on.
To finish our News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, we love to groove into the weekend with our colleagues at IPR Studio One Tracks. Tony Daner joins me now. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben.
Well, have you got a sweater on, a flannel shirt, something on?
I've got a sweater on, yeah.
You do? Okay.
And I've got some music that, as it turns out, is good for cold weather days, which I thought we were done with the cold weather music, but apparently not. But here we go. Yeah.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah.
Good to have it.
Do it to us. What do you have first up?
We're going to start with Iron and Wine, who's been around for a long time. Sam Beam, the singer-songwriter, basically is Iron and Wine. With the latest in his archive series, this is Volume 5, the Tallahassee recordings. All these recordings go back a while. This latest is his first recordings as Iron and Wine. He actually recorded this in the late 90s while he was a student at Florida State and ended up releasing his actual debut album a few years later. And listening to this, it's pretty incredible that he heard this and was like, I could do better. So, but this is Iron and Wine and This Solemn Day.
This Solemn Day by Iron and Wine. I love that selection, Tony. Warming
so
me
good.
Up.
Yeah.
Warming me up that those vocals are just, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, hard to imagine Sam Beam just deciding there's more where that came from, you know, and then releasing a completely different debut album.
Right. Okay, we have time for one more, Tony. What do you have for us?
Yeah, new music from the folk rock trio Lula Wiles. Their new album is called Shame and Sedition. Lula Wiles always have a lot to say about the world around them and relationships and all kinds of topics. And they managed to do it with a really wicked sense of humor and some kind of crushing one-liners on this album. Makes me think of Bob Dylan at his most acerbic on songs, like where he's clearly just telling somebody off and you can't help but wonder who he's talking about. Lula Wiles have that same gift, and you're really going to hear that on this song called Oh My God.
Building from
Okay, we'll have Lula Wiles cut loose a little bit more and take us out. Tony Daner, nice selection there as well. Tony, along with Mark Simmet, CC Mitchell, of course, our IPR Studio One Tracks hosts. Tune in Monday through Friday at 7 p.m. Also on the weekends. Tony, you have a wonderful weekend. Stay warm in that sweater of yours.
Thanks, Ben. You too.
All right. River to River, today produced by Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful long weekend, and let's look out for some of that sunshine coming our way. Bye now.